Oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are posted in the clerk's office and available for dissemination there. There are three clauses set for oral submission this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Wamco Inc. versus Market Planners Insurance Agency Inc. from Dallas County. Judd McElvain and others versus Emmerich Jacobs Jr. and Joyce Moore from Harris County. And Guardian Royal Exchange Assurance Limited versus English China Clay PLC and others from Gonzales County. We will complete the submission of these three causes this morning before we take our lunch break. We will have those argued in the order in which I've read them out, and we'll take a brief recess in between the submission of each argument. Counsel in the second and third causes are not required to remain in the courtroom while causes prior to yours are being submitted, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we can proceed to your argument without delay in the event that the argument in front of yours finishes earlier than anticipated. Counsel in all three causes are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Should you desire to listen to the tapes of these arguments, you may make application to do so with the clerk of our court. In the first cause, Wamco Inc. versus Market Planners Insurance Agency, Inc., the petitioner has been allotted 20 minutes for oral argument, the respondent 20 minutes for oral argument, and the petitioner 10 minutes for rebuttal. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner.
This is a post-answer default judgment case. Market Planners is an insurance agency in Dallas, and they sued Wamco, which is a trucking firm in Van Wheeler, Texas, for non-payment of insurance premiums. Wamco answered and filed a counterclaim that failed to appear for trial. After hearing testimony, the trial court granted judgment for Market Planners and dismissed Wamco's counterclaim of prejudice. Wamco's motion for new trial and motion to reconsider were denied by the trial court. Wamco appealed the trial court's decision, and the Court of Appeals affirmed as follows. Number one, Wamco's failure to appear at trial was intentional. Number two, Market Planners adequately pleaded and proved its cause of action for breach of contract. And three, the counterclaim filed by Wamco was compulsory, and the trial court's dismissal was prejudice. Wamco now brings this appeal from the judgment of the Court of Appeals on three points of error. First point of error. Because Wamco satisfied the three-pronged credit test in its motion for a new trial, the Court of Appeals erred in holding that Wamco's failure to attend trial was intentional or the result of conscious indifference. In support of its motion for a new trial, Wamco submitted the affidavit testimony of its attorney, J.W. Steiner, which attempted to explain the reason for Wamco's failure to appear at trial. Mr. Steiner described the events leading to the default as follows. Because of a failure in the diary system of his office, the pre-trial schedule and the trial setting were never calendared. Upon receiving a copy of plaintiff's amended petition during the week of June 8th, Mr. Steiner realized that trial date was imminent, and also that he was unprepared to defend the main claim, and thirdly, that he had a cause of action on behalf of his client, Wamco, that had never been filed in the form of a counterclaim. He testified in his affidavit, I attempted to assure myself that the case would not go to trial on the 22nd. During the days that followed, he testified to the following actions. During the week of June 15th, he made two phone calls to opposing counsel. to find out, in their opinion, whether or not the case would be heard, and learned that, in the opinion of the attorney for Margaret Sanders, there was very little likelihood that the case would be reached. On June the 19th, he made a trip to Dallas to file a motion for continuance and so now it's not ready. At that time, he learned the case was number 25 on the docket.
Counsel, is there some dispute whether or not he did in fact announce not ready?
The court coordinator, Linda Norris, testified in her affidavit that she did not remember that. She did not testify that he did not make it. On the June the 22nd, Mr. Tyner mailed an amended motion for continuance to supply an additional fact that he'd been omitted from the first motion, and that means that he was committed to be in another town for depositions on the 22nd. Also on the 22nd, he received a message from the court coordinator that the case was number 10 on the docket. He testified that he assumed that he would receive further notice on the court if the case was reached for trial.
But he mailed on the day before work, it was set for the 23rd, and he mailed the motion for continuance on the 22nd?
An amended motion. He'd already filed.
I understand, but is the postal service that good between Tyler and Dallas that you can get overnight service and be sure that it's going to be seen by the post next morning?
No, sir. Since it's so far down on the docket, it's December 25th.
Well, then at the point the mailing took place, Mr. Tyner assumed that it was going to be continued.
I think at that point he assumed it wouldn't be breached.
This was a non-jury docket, was it not?
Yes. We learned later that it was kind of a special docket in our experience, the fact that it was number 25 was good cause to believe that it would not be breached.
You must never try a case in Dallas before.
Did he have a copy of the local rules? Did he have a copy of the local rules of Dallas?
Yes, we did. The local rules provided for the announcement are not ready on the Friday before. In response to Wanko's motion for new trial, Wanko's planner submitted the affidavit testimony of Linda Norris, a court coordinator who spoke with Mr. Pine on the 19th and called the office on the 22nd. She testified that he was in Dallas and he spoke with her about the Wanko Market Planner's case. She testified, as we just noted, that she didn't remember an announcement and not ready. She also testified that she called his office and told someone she assumed to be his secretary that the case was now number 10 on the docket and that Mr. Tyner should appear at 9 o'clock on June 23rd for trial.
There's no contest of that. It's agreed that that happened.
Mr. Tyner testified that the message he received was just that the court, that the case was under 10 on the docket.
Not from the coordinator, from his secretary.
From the secretary.
So the coordinator's statement that she advised the secretary that he should appear on the 23rd is undisputed in the record.
The default occurred, the motion for new trial was filed, and a hearing was set on the motion for new trial. Mr. Tyner hired a Dallas attorney to represent Wanko at that hearing so that he could testify on the issue of conscious indifference. He also took Cindy King, who was the secretary in the office, who took the message from Linda Norris so she could testify to the court as to the message she received and the message she transmitted to Mr. Tyner. After a very brief argument before the bench, the court denied the motion for new trial without hearing testimony from Mr. Tyner and Cindy King.
Did Wanko request a hearing?
Yes.
Where is that in the record?
In the hearing on the motion for new trial.
What am I? In the hearing on the motion for new trial?
Yes, sir.
Wanko requested an evidentiary hearing.
I believe Mr. Carroll That's not right in front of me, but to the best of my memory, Mr. Carroll indicated that Mr. Piner and Cindy King were there to testify. And let me add that because that proceeding was so short and abbreviated, we filed a motion to reconsider, and in that motion to reconsider, we did make it clear that we were requesting an evidentiary hearing so that Mr. Piner and Cindy King would testify on the issue of conflict of interest. Again, we hired Mr. Carroll to represent WOMCO at that hearing so that Mr. Piner could testify as a fact witness. Again, Cindy King was in doubt so that she could give her testimony. But there was another very abbreviated proceeding before the court, and no evidentiary hearing was ever had.
Why isn't there a bill of exceptions?
It's no issue.
Why isn't that fatal to your position?
Well, the motion for new trial presented affidavit testimony, which met the three-prong test in the Craddock case, that our failure to appear was not intentional, but we did have a meritorious defense to the main action and an offer to reimburse the plaintiff for the cost incurred in taking the default judgment. The bill of exceptions would have preserved the error about the failure of the court to hear evidence upon the request of the defendant WOMCO. But some cases have held that once this affidavit testimony establishes the three points of the Craddock test, that it's incumbent upon the party resisting the trial to ask for an evidentiary hearing.
I'm confused on one of the facts here, and you can help me out. I was under the impression that after the attorney was told he was number 10 on the docket, that he did not receive any further notice and assumed he would get notice and didn't get it. I thought he said something a minute ago about he was told to be in court on that Monday.
Linda North testified that the message she gave Senior King was that the case was number 10 on the docket and the should be there for trial the next morning at 9 o'clock.
Is that disputed?
Mr. Piner testified first. The sequence might help clarify that. His affidavit was filed first, and he just testified that he received a message that the case had moved up to number 10 on the docket, and that he assumed that he would be notified further if the case was actually reached. Then, in response to that, Linda Norris testified that she told Cindy King that he should be there at 9:30. That's when we arranged for Cindy King to testify to the court as to the message she had received and transmitted. That testimony was never heard.
Did Cindy King make an affidavit?
No, sir.
Why not?
Well, I guess we could have and just didn't think of it. At that time, the motion had already been filed and the response had already been filed and the hearing set. And instead of filing an affidavit, we made the decision just to take her up there and testify in person.
And you may know, there's nothing in the record showing at that hearing that you requested oral testimony.
I'm not sure about that.
Nowhere is that witness's testimony preserved, Paul.
The request is in the record and the motion to reconsider that she mentioned by name and requested that a hearing be held so she could testify.
Absent this problem of not being allowed to present your whole case, based on the case we have before the trial court, why wasn't the trial court permitted to believe her own coordinator as opposed to a lawyer practicing before the court if there's a conflict in the testimony? Why is that an abuse of discretion under Craddock?
This court has said that in answer to the question whether the default is an intentional or a mistake, you have to look at the act and the knowledge of the defendant. And Mr. Piner has testified to his actions, which belie just an indifferent attitude or an intentional disregard.
Well, we've also said that the trial judge can resolve factual disputes.
Yes, sir.
And a trial is more important than a deposition.
In addition, Mr. Pine testified as to his knowledge and his understanding of the message he received from the court coordinator. His knowledge is uncontroverted. Linda Norris' testimony is that she gave a message to Cindy King, a third person who was to be there.
She who was his agent?
Yes, sir. And she is, did not testify and could not testify that Mr. Pine actually received that message.
Wasn't the burden his to negate that he did not receive?
The court has said once the affidavit before the motion for new trial presents a prima facie case that tends to negate conscious indifference, that the burden has been met. And in this case, the testimony of J.W. Tyner is to the actions he took and the knowledge he had not been controverted. There's the affidavit testimony of Linda Norris, which does not directly controvert his testimony.
Is there any evidence that he thereafter contacted the court to find out the status of the case?
No, sir.
He just assumed that he had not been reached?
Yes, sir.
Does he regularly practice in Dallas County?
No, sir.
Another example of local rules.
Well,
one of many.
Not to get in a colloquy on the court, but I don't understand the local rule. But do you, counsel, do you have any knowledge of any local rule that's in play here?
The only local rule that I'm aware of that is applicable is the rule that the counsel allows to announce not ready to the court the Friday before.
But it does not suspend your obligation to appear when it's up.
No, that's just a provision for. The second point of error on this appeal is that because market planners failed to adequately plea and prove the cause of action for breach of contract, the court of appeal judgment that there was adequately breach of error. Very briefly, there were four causes of action pled in the amended petition. An action on account, breach of contract, quantum error, and common law debt. The Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court as to the cause of action for breach of contract. The pleading and the proof are very general. The pleading and proof refer to an agreement reached between the two parties that neither sets out the terms of the agreement. One has to assume facts not in evidence to find using terms of this contract. In particular, one has to assume the relationship of market planners, WOMCO, and the third-party insurance provider. Market planners is an agent or a middleman between the insured and the insurer. And to award damages for breach of contract, you have to assume that the terms of the agreement obligated market planners to pay insurance premiums on behalf of WOMCO, whether or not WOMCO paid market planners for the insurance. In addition, one has to assume that market planners did actually pay those premiums and that their payment was caused by WOMCO's breach. The third point of error, the Court of Appeals was wrong to affirm the trial court's dismissal of prejudice of WOMCO's counterclaim. The trial court was allowed by Rule 165A to dismiss the counterclaim for WOMCO's prosecution, but there's no provision for dismissal of prejudice of a compulsory counterclaim. In addition, the issue of whether or not it was a compulsory counterclaim has not been raised except by the Court of Appeals, and the proper time to do that would be on remand after this wrongful dismissal of prejudice is corrected.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is now ready to hear oral argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Jeffrey
Burns,
Assistant United States Attorney,
will present argument to respondent. Mr. Burns, the law office is Jerome H. Ferguson, on the terms of the respondent. May it please the Court, we have filed a motion to dismiss for want of jurisdiction, and this is contained in the brief. The arguments and authorities in support of that are in the brief, and there is additional support in our response to Blomko's motion to supplement jurisdiction. At certain points, I will address the rest of it. With regard to the point of error number one, I think there's some additional facts that are relevant. Particularly, Blomko had failed to comply with the pretrial order of the court. Among other things, they had not filed a list of witnesses, they had not filed a list of exhibits, trial pleadings, list of depositions, excerpts, findings of facts, conclusions of law. They had failed to comply with the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 73 by providing market planners with copies of certain pleadings. They had violated the local rules and Rule 66, the Rules of Civil Procedure, in filing the counterclaim without leave of the court. The counterclaim was filed.
Did market planners file all that information prior to trial?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. The counterclaim of Blomko was filed the day the case was set for trial. Blomko's counsel did not, they did file a motion for continuance the working day, the first working day before the case was set, but they did not have the motion for continuance set. They did not make any attempt to speak to the judge. There is no evidence before the court that the court coordinator would announce not ready for Mr. Tyner, or that she would contact Mr. Tyner if the case was called for trial. I think that the point of error number one goes to the factual sufficiency of the evidence, and this court has ruled in numerous decisions that appellate court's decision would be final under the circumstances, and those cases are in my brief. Also, as the court has noted, the denial of the motion for new trial would not be disturbed absent a clear abuse of the trial court's discretion. I don't think that's the case here. I'll address my arguments only to the mistake or accident aspect of the Craddock test, because this appears to be what the Court of Appeals has based its decision on. The defendant's own motion and affidavit showed the conscious indifference and disregard. And I believe this is the basis for the appeals court concerned affirming the trial court.
Let me interrupt you here, just not to get you off the point, but do you concede the other two prongs of the credit test?
No, I do not.
You concede one prong that they offered to reimburse your costs?
I think that there are some errors in there. For one thing, they offered to reimburse the cost as set forth in the affidavit, and then the affidavit that they submitted did not address that issue at all. I think there are some
issues. We're pretty generous on that. The court has been.
They may be technical errors.
Okay, I just wanted to.
That we certainly do not concede the merit court's defense. I don't think they please set that up.
All right, go on back to your principal.
While you're interrupted, let me ask you, did you advise Mr. Tynes that this case was not likely to be reached at the time of the process?
I spoke to Mr. Tyner on several occasions. This was several weeks before trial. At that time, the case was 25 on the docket, and he asked me if I thought it could be reached. And, well, first of all, he said, made some statements that he would not push his motion to transfer if we would reset it. And then on the second call,
counsel, excuse me, is this in the record what you're telling us now? Is this your personal recollection?
This is in the record.
Okay.
He also said that on the second call that he would file a motion, a counterclaim, or a separate action, actually, in Van Zandt County if we did not agree to pass the case. I told him that our client was not agreeable to pass the case. We could not do that. He asked me if I thought it would reach. I said, since it's 25 about this, it probably would. That was the extent of that conversation.
It's something contained in an affidavit that you have in the record?
Yes, it is in the record. And that was when it was number 25, it was about the subsequent rose to number 4.
Approximately when did that conversation take place?
That was on the 15th of June, I believe. It is in our brief. It is at least a week before the trial.
Was there a request for an evidentiary hearing made afterwards, at the hearing? Same question that opposing counsel was asked a while ago about whether there was any request made in front of the judge for a hearing.
At the motion for new trial, there was no request whatsoever. At the motion to reconsider, which was number 5 until 30 days after the judgment, the counsel indicated that they wanted to put on some evidence. They did not push that point, and they did not make a deliberate statement.
Motion
for either of those hearings reported?
The motion to reconsider is, there's a transcript made of that. There was no transcript of the motion for new trial.
Did Ms. King testify at the motion to reconsider?
No, she did not. She did not testify at anything.
You actually had a conversation. Just kind of about whether or not the case comes to trial. On one occasion, you told him that you didn't
take the case to trial. No, I only told him that on one occasion. The first conversation was dealt with whether we would pass the case, and I indicated that we did not pass the case.
This motion for new trial then just consisted of argument of counsel.
The motion for new trial. They submitted a brief, affidavit in support of their motion. We submitted several counter affidavits, and there was no testimony or questions by the side.
If the court coordinator contacted Mr. Tynan's secretary and told him to appear on June 23rd, and by mistake or inadvertence or some other fault, the secretary failed to pass that information on to her boss, wouldn't that be a lack of conscious indifference that would establish the right first prong of predicate?
The justice is indicating prudence, but I think the counsel may be bound by the secretary to be heard. And the trial court judge did not base her decision to deny the motion of the trial solely on failure to appear at the trial. She indicates that it was also due to a repeated failure on their part to comply with orders, etc. It's not solely on the decision, solely on the failure to appear to the trial.
Is the standard for conscious indifference for failure to show up at the trial same as the standard for conscious indifference for a no answer default judgment? The courts have been very liberal on no answer default judgments in deciding what conscious indifference is and in overruling trial courts that refuse to grant a new trial. The court has shown a similar trend in post-answer default judgments, or is there more discretion accorded to the trial judge's decision in those kind of cases where the trial judge has to deal with it?
I think that, I don't know if it's per se a different standard, but there are certainly a lot more circumstances that can be considered.
Do you have any cases that show that?
I have the case of Murray versus Dowling, and I just recently came across this case. It's not in my brief. It's 524 Southwest 2nd, 409. Texas Civil Appeals case from Eastland, 1975. In this case, the attorney was told by opposing counsel that the case would not be passed by agreement. The attorney called the court clerk and was informed that the case probably would be passed. However, the attorney did not talk to the judge, and he did not file a motion for continuance, and the court found that that was insufficient. The case of Zamora v. Jones, which is in the brief, that's 607 Southwest 616. In that case, the attorney had 3 days' notice of the trial. That's all he received. He only received 3 days' notice of the trial sentence. He was out of town, and the court found that his excuse was not sufficient, did not establish a sufficient reason for not getting the continuance. So I believe the court would be strict under those circumstances where the counsel never fails to address the problem.
Well, let me be sure I understand. If the court notified counsel personally to appear in trial and counsel forgot to write that down or slipped his mind or he made some mistake and established that by affidavit, would that or would that not establish the first prong of the Craddock test?
If it's purely a mistake, perhaps it would. I don't think that's the case here. I think that Mr. Conner is aware of the trial setting, and he's admitted that he's aware of the trial setting. He made some conscious choices not to prepare for trial, and several conscious reasons for why, for one thing, he assumed that the docket, that he would not be reading.
Well, coming back first to the other point, if counsel makes a mistake, that may entitle him to a new trial under the Craddock test. I guess, what is the difference between counsel making the mistake and counsel's secretary making?
If it was purely a mistake, I suppose it would not be a difference whether it made a mistake or not. I don't think that's a situation.
The difference between being negligent and being conscious is different.
Some of the decisions say that negligent mistake.
Once a trial lawyer is notified that he is number 10, does he have a duty to affirmatively keep in contact with the court to determine his position on the docket?
I know in Dallas County, I think that he just assumed that he would be further contacted. The court coordinator stated in her affidavit that she did not make this statement, that she would be in contact with him further. And she also told the secretary that he absolutely had to be there on the morning of the 23rd. There's several factors. His own affidavit and motion showed that he had notice on June 22nd of the trial setting on June 8th. He relied on the opinion of the case to not be reached. He chose not to make the extraordinary effort to prepare for trial. He did not set his motion for continuous hearing. Coordinator called on June 22nd, informed that the case was number 10, and counsel was aware of the coordinator call. He assumed that he would be called back to face the call
Counsel, are you saying that he relied upon what the other lawyer told him, that he did not think it would be reasonable?
There's in the record, in the briefs or the affidavit, it states that the conversation was that I say I didn't feel it would be reasonable.
I understand that. I've read that. Do you feel that he is entitled to rely on your opinion?
He did not rely solely on my opinion. His opinion as well. And he stated that. But also, I don't think it was, even if it was relying solely on my opinion, I don't think that is sufficient. And this is subsequent to that conversation is when he was informed that it's number 10 on the docket.
You're a lawyer in Dallas and notifies you number 10. Pay real close attention, or is that a pretty good signal that probably won't be needed?
I'm paying close attention.
Are the jury and non-jury dockets separated up there ordinarily, or not?
Yes, sir.
Do they move at the same rate?
No, they do not. Yes. Non-jury would obviously
be. So if you were told you were number 10 on the non-jury docket, it's your feeling it should be there. The lawyer should be there.
Well, since in this court, they had an appearance that he was told to be there at that time, no matter what, whether you're in the region or not, you have to be there. And what as I previously said, they did not make any attempt at all to offer evidence of the motion for new trial. The cases that are cited by the petitioner in the brief, I think these cases deal with where the affidavit and for the motion for new trial has not been controverted, and therefore the court has to rely on the movement's affidavit. There are distinguishing factors in all of those cases. I think the burden is clearly on the movement to prove the content of the difference. With respect to the oral contract, this is point of error number two. This is clearly a sufficiency of the evidence question, and our petition was sufficient in giving notice and stating cause of action. Under the court's decision in Stoner v. Thompson, I think that the petition was clearly sufficient. And of particular importance, Wonka raised no objection prior to the appeal regarding the pleading or the lack of evidence. This is not raised at any time in the trial court. Had evidence on all of those elements. With regard to 5.3, there was a consistent failure to comply with the rules of procedure and court's order. The counterclaim was filed the day of set for trial. It is a compulsory counterclaim. We did raise this in our brief to the is raised in our response to the motion for new trial. And as the judge stated, the failure to appear for trial is not the sole basis for denying the motion for new trial. It is also the consistent disregard of orders and rules.
When you say consistent disregard, did they do anything other than fail to comply with the form letter pretrial order, which they claim they didn't get or calendar properly?
We had filed they did not comply with the pretrial order. File the counterclaim without getting legal support. There's some several other things that are there.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
you talk a little louder, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. Rule 90 allows objections to defects in pleadings to be raised for the first time on appeal in default judgment situations. Also, the case of Griffin v. Watson does indicate that the Craddock test is applied in the same fashion in post-answer default judgment cases as it is in the post-answer default judgment cases. Finally, the defendant's negligence is not the same quality of fault as an intentional disregard. And there may be a lot of negligence and stupidity on the part of Wamco's counsel in this case, but that does not justify denial of a motion for a new trial.
Well, we're talking about the motion for the trial. Counsel says he did not offer to make proof or offer testimony at the hearing on the motion for the trial. Did you or not?
I'm not sure about that, sir. I wasn't there, and I just have to say I'm not sure about that. There was no record made of that hearing.
What about his
contention? I can say that Ms. King and Mr. Tyler were there to testify, and that was their intent.
What about his contention that it failed to comply with the pretrial order?
That's true. When the amended decision was received, that was one of the alarms that went off in our office. We had not diaried any of the dates in the pretrial schedule. We did not diary the trial date.
Mr. Tyler and King were there and they proceeded on affidavits. Whose affidavit was it? In the motion for new trial.
Mr.
Tyner was there and he submitted an affidavit. So then it's unlikely that he would offer to testify as well.
Well, the affidavit of Linda Norris raised a question about the message he received.
Now, who is Linda Norris?
The court coordinator.
But she was there.
Well, Cindy King was there on one hand to testify as to that message. And Mr. Tyner wanted to give testimony as well.
So Ms. Norris submitted an affidavit. Wamco, the other side, the market planner submitted the affidavit.
From
Linda Norris, was she present at the same time?
In closing, I'd just like to say that the remedy of default judgment is necessary to penalize an intentional failure to appear. But it's a harsh remedy, and it seems to be particularly harshly applied in this case. Most courts recognize that a slight excuse is enough to warrant a new trial. And the cases recognize that the cost of taking the default judgment to the plaintiff can be shifted to the defendant as a condition of the new trial. So in effect, no harm is done in granting a new trial. The potential for harm is great, however, to the
how, if at all, is it related to this?
Still the boss.
Any other questions? Thank you, Pat. That concludes the submission of the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.